While you were playing Oblivion or Tetris DS, we were at GDC covering the IGF and Video Games Live. We'll tell you all about that and take your live calls and chat comments on the Bobby Blackwolf Show, week of March 26th, 2006. Bobby Blackwolf Show, you're on the air.
Calling in to chime in about this, Matt. And
it's your fault, Doc Wolf. It's you guys who buy these dumb Katamari, Kamari, Catalarm, kind of that game.
Bobby Blackwolf back at Dragon Con 2005.
I am here at Anime Weekend Atlanta 11. I'm here at the Best Buy in Alpharetta, Georgia, talking about the Xbox 360 launch.
DC Nate and everybody in chat's all going, we didn't buy into the hype. You did buy into the hype, you just didn't buy the system.
From a little room in Atlanta, Georgia, it's Bobby Blackwolf.
Hello, hello. How's everybody doing out there? Doing some last-minute stuff with the stream because it's not being nice tonight. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Bobby Blackwolf Show, where we discuss the current news affecting the video game industry, as well as reminisce about gaming's history. My name is Bobby Blackwolf. We are hanging out in the AllGames.com chat room on the GameSurge IRC network, or go to chat.allgames.com to go into our Java chat client. We're going to have our Skype line open if you want to call into the show live. Our Skype line is Bobby Blackwolf Show, all one word. We're also going to open up our toll-free number, which is 1-866-880-0156 if you're listening live and want to interact with the show. Or if you're listening to the podcast, you can leave us a voicemail on that Skype line, Bobby Blackwolf Show, or email me, blackwolf@allgames.com, if you want to have your email read on the air and answered on the air. And as always, I want to thank Kropotkin for providing the short UK news segment that runs just before this show goes live. It's available as a podcast feed for those who cannot tune in live. Check it out on our website, bobbyblackwolfshow.com, or at his site, kropotkin.co.uk. Now, I was at Game Developer Conference this past week out in San Jose, and which means that I don't have that much, like, really prepared for this show. The thing that got to me the most because I was out at Game Developer Conference is everybody else has been playing Oblivion or Tetris DS. I haven't been able to play either of these. Tetris DS was on the show floor. I wasn't able to get onto a DS Lite to play it, and Oblivion wasn't there, and they're games I really want to know about, and unfortunately Kingdom Hearts 2 and Beatmania come out this coming week. So I'd love to hear later on in the show, I'll open up the line, I want somebody who's played both of these games to tell me about them and tell us about them, because I feel like I'm doing the people who listen to the show a disservice by not having played them yet, but they came out the day I flew out. But there was a lot of stuff that went on at GDC, and you know, I was able to attend things because this is really the first time I've attended a gaming event as media. And if you listened to Kropotkin's newscast before we go on, it's also available as a podcast. He actually said that I didn't belong there. I did not belong there. None of the media belonged at Game Developer Conference. It's as much of a trade show as E3, just because they call it a conference instead of a convention. And, you know, I understand Guido was telling me in chat that he believes that, you know, media shouldn't have been there because some of the sessions were full, which was true, and there were sessions we couldn't get in because they were full, and a developer could have learned something if there was not a media person sitting in that seat. And, you know, I can kind of see that, but, you know, they do invite the media. They have the whole press thing. You know, I didn't see the media overtaking anything. That was pretty much the only thing that you could probably say that the media was doing that was harming GDC, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of media there, contrary to what people believe. We were one of the only people that had microphones that I saw. You know, there were no TV crews. There were very little TV crews. I did see, like, one or two. And, you know, there were some, you know, microphones, but, in you know, I didn't see that much media. There wasn't that many web media. The media room was very small. So, you know, I understand that people probably think that, you know, I don't belong at GDC, even though I am a programmer and I have done music for games and I've programmed for games and all that stuff. But, you know, there are people that probably believe that I don't belong at GDC. And we're just going to have to respectfully agree to disagree on that one, Kropotkin. But thanks for your input. Now, Gita says that it's more of a conference than expo, but then they have an exhibition hall, so that makes it an expo. That's like the definition of an expo. And he says there's way more conferences than expo stuff, and I agree. You know, GDC starts at 9 in the morning. You can't get in the expo hall until 11:30. So that's why people go to the keynotes at 10:30 and all that stuff. And Gita says the first 2 days there wasn't even an expo, and that's why I wasn't there the first 2 days. You know, I understand that people probably think the media don't belong there, but the media really wasn't there in force. And, you know, and actually the people that I wound up talking to, like the Independent Games Festival people, they were absolutely thrilled to be talked to the media. And, you know, I learned stuff there. Fantas says you learned stuff there. I learned stuff there. You know, I am a technical person. Maybe I'm a little bit different than a lot of the media there. I am a technical person. I've done game music. If you listen, when we do the booth crawl for All Games Interactive, both Scott and I did the booth crawl, which should be up on the feed this week. We mentioned that I actually have something on Moby Games on me. So I actually have a rap sheet on Moby Games. So anyway, enough about me. I really don't want to talk about me. I just want to bring that up, and that there are people that believe that media shouldn't be there. If you believe we shouldn't be there, email me, blackwolf@allgames.com. I'll read it on the air. One of the first things that I saw when I was there was we got into the Sony keynote, which they actually had media rows, so you can get all upset about that if you couldn't get into the Sony keynote, with Phil Harrison. And the thing is, they showed us stuff. They showed us a lot of things about the PS3. They just weren't all that impressive. Now, I mean, I guess here's my thing, and I actually said this on the Gang pre-show, which we'll get to later, is that I've seen great graphics come out of the PS3. I have seen great physics come out of the PS3. I've seen great other things come out of the PS3. I have never seen any of these come out at the same time. I have never seen something that has great graphics and physics. I've seen great physics and mediocre graphics. I've seen great graphics with no physics, you know, where it's just like a static scene. You know, it's being rendered in real time, but there's nothing going on, except you're looking at this scene that's not moving. And so my first reaction was Microsoft does not need to worry, because there is nothing about the PS3 that the Xbox 360 can't do. The only thing the PS... Actually, I take that back. The only thing the PS3 can do is play PS1 and PS2 games natively in backward compatibility. And then it also has the PSP that it can do location-free stuff, where you can watch your PS3 media on your PSP anywhere in the world. I still have no clue how that's going to work. But other than that, you know, they're talking about the digital distribution. I mean, I really liked on the PSP that you're going to be able to download PS1 games onto your memory stick, and they're finally going to do their own games on the memory stick, something homebrewers have been doing since the unit came out. They're going to finally allow that to happen. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that works, and see if they finally, you know, close down the homebrewers, or if there's going to be a real reason to upgrade. So it's going to be interesting to see that, and see how they do that. And they announced the GPS and talked a little bit about the GPS. I wonder what's going to use it. They mentioned geocaching in the GPS unit for the PSP, which is something that I actually have done before. I enjoy geocaching. If you've never done geocaching, it's a treasure hunt. But basically what they do, and you go, I think it's geocaching.org, and you go to this the site, and you put in your location, and it'll say, okay, there's a geocache at these GPS coordinates. And what you do is you put those GPS coordinates in your GPS receiver, and then you go find that cache. And when you find it, it's like a Tupperware box or some kind of other box that can be, you know, hidden underneath leaves or something. And you sign the registry. You may like take something out of it, put something else in, and then you go back to the site, say, "Hey, I found it," stuff like that. And there really isn't a good cheap GPS unit. But if you have a PSP and you can buy a cheap GPS unit for the PSP, that would be a good use of it. Unfortunately, I can't think of a single other use for a GPS right now. You know, maybe unless there's like multiplayer games where it actually like checks where you are, but then you have to play those outside because that's the only way you can get a GPS signal. You can't play that indoors. So I don't know what they're going to really do with that. It's just going to be another, you know, thing on it. But other than that, I mean, God of War 2 looked nice, and it was a PS2 game, and it looks great, and they're still pushing the power out of the PS2. That was really all that they really showed at the PS3 keynote. Now, they did show two different PS3s on the stage, and I've got a picture of it that I need to upload, where like one was the gray that we're used to, and one was solid white. still looked the same. They were still curved and everything. We thought one was flat, but they're still both curved. So I don't know what that meant. You know, they had all the Sony units, and they had like the original PS1 and then the small PS1 and the original PS2 and the PS2 Slimline. Then they had the black PSP and the white PSP, and then they had two PS3s. I don't know what the significance of that PS3 was. But one thing they did say after the keynote was that the PS3 was going to be region-free, which is going to be something very interesting. A lot of people are going to like that, especially since with the Blu-ray disc, developers are actually excited about being able to have all localization on one disc. They're very excited about that. And I was actually talking, when I flew back to Atlanta, I was actually talking to a developer from Red Storm. I don't know his name, forgot his name, but he was telling me, and I was telling him what I thought, and I guess he's played with a PS3 dev kit and stuff. And so he's just like, you know, just wait. You know, because he said, yeah, I understand that that's how you feel about the PS3, that it's underwhelming, based on what you've seen. All the demos we saw in the keynote were from December. I don't care. I wanted to see stuff from, you know, March 21st, and the keynote was on the 22nd. But he says, just wait, you know, and he says that the PS3 has its advantages and its disadvantages. The Xbox 360 has advantages and disadvantages. So they're holding all their cards until E3. Fantas says that Sony can never fail, and GK128 says, just like the Betamax. Let's see. Fifth Dream says, I'm sure you can use the DualShock on PS3. Are there any more buttons? Now, we actually did see the controller. They did have PS3 dev kits, and it really didn't look... It wasn't running like the PS3 hardware. It was like this big box with a light in the front of it. But they were using PS2 DualShock controllers that had a USB attachment on the top. It looked like a mini USB plug into the top of the controller. So the wire didn't come out of the controller. It actually came into the controller via mini USB. So I thought that was something interesting to note on that. But you know what? At least we got information from Sony on the PS3. The Nintendo keynote was the next morning at 10:30. And I can sum up the entire Nintendo keynote that Satoru Iwata did in less than a minute. You ready? Here we go. This is the entire keynote. This is everything you need to know. Hey guys, how you doing? We have this game, it's called Brain Age. A lot of people don't understand it, but it's really cool. Here, we're going to bring some people up to play it. Disruption, disruption, disruption. Oh, and everybody here gets a copy of Brain Age. Show it to all your parents and your grandparents. Disruption, disruption, disruption. Oh, by the way, we also have this game, it's called Metroid. It came out, it's really fun, multiplayer. Disruption, disruption, disruption. Oh, yeah, we've got this other game, it's called Zelda DS, and you use the stylus on it. Disruption, disruption, disruption. Oh, yeah, we have this Revolution thing, and it's got this funky controller that people can't understand. Disruption, disruption, disruption. Oh, and we're going to have Genesis and TurboGrafx games on it. Disruption, disruption, disruption. Have a nice day. That was the entire Nintendo keynote. It was 1 hour long, summed up into that. And, you know, man, I would have been so drunk if I had taken a shot every single time I heard the word disruption on the stage. Everybody remembered disruption. Nintendo is all about disruption. And, you know, I also understand that, you know, I don't know English all that well. And when Satoru Iwata was on stage telling jokes, I had to, like, you know, wait for Lawrence, who was actually translating for Scott, to tell Scott what he just said, and then I could laugh. You know, I didn't get much about the Nintendo talk, and everybody thought, oh, we're going to get the new name for the Revolution. We're not going to get the new name for the Revolution until E3. Everybody is holding their cards very close until E3. At least Nintendo, or at least Sony, showed me something. They said something. Nintendo didn't say anything. Nintendo said two whole things that I hadn't heard before, and they told a lot of stories. Now, the cool thing is we did get a copy of Brain Age. And I don't think it's out yet. I think it's coming out next month or something. But I do have a copy of Brain Age. And no, I'm not giving it away because I've already started playing it. Sorry, guys. Scott may be giving one away. I'm not sure. And it's very interesting. The thing about Brain Age, though, is everybody knows. Everybody would know if you were playing Brain Age because you turn the DS on its side. Touch screen's on the right and the non-touch screen is on the left. And that's how you play is, you know, you draw and you use the entire right screen for, like, drawing numbers and stuff like that. It's got voice recognition that sucks. When you do play Brain Age, one of the tests on there is that it pops up a word that's a specific color. And the word could be blue, and if the color is blue, you're supposed to say blue. But if the word is yellow and the color is blue, you're supposed to say blue. So, and it does that, and it times you on stuff. Unfortunately, it doesn't understand the word blue. So I'll be going through red, black, yellow, blue, 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 blue. And I'd be just going there, going through just like that, trying to get it to recognize blue. And it's like, we can't hear you. Please, you know, or sit a foot away. So they could have really worked on the voice recognition of blue. I mean, it only needs to recognize like five words. Couldn't they have worked on it? But so, yeah, I haven't really figured that out. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. But it checks your brain age using all these little mind puzzles. And it really does make you sharper the more you play it. You know, I don't remember my multiplication tables all that much from school, but they're coming back. And after I was doing the calculation game, where basically it has like simple calculations like 11 minus 3, you know, 6 times 9, 4 minus 0, 4 plus 4, 4 times 8, you know, and it'll go like that. And it's how fast can you do 20 of these or 100 of these or, you know, whatever. And there's some other ones where, like, you have to, like, remember, like, the order of the numbers. It shows you, like, six numbers on the screen for, like, 1 second or less than a second. And then you have to remember what order from low to high those numbers were. And so, and it, you know, it sharpens your brain. I can see why it, you know, people like it and it sharpens their brain. So I will probably give a more thorough review as it comes out. I've really only touched it today for a couple hours, and I really don't think that that's enough because it unlocks things every day for you. And so I'm going to wait until I get everything unlocked before I go in there and talk more about it. Gita says that Black Wolf left out the part where Will Wright owns. No, I haven't. I'm going to get to Will Wright and Ronald D. Moore, who does Battlestar Galactica. This is All Games Radio. It's not just talk about games. It's what gamers are talking about. And Ron Moore gave a wonderful talk on adaptation, on adapting an old property into a new property between the old TV series and the new TV series. And I'm going to touch a little bit on that. I realize there's not a video game based on it right now, but he did explain what his ideal video game would be right at the beginning of the talk. But right now what I'm going to do is I actually interviewed just a couple of the IGF finalists. I do have the winners of the finalists here. I'm going to pull that up right now. Darwinia took everything, just like I predicted. It took the grand prize. It also took technical excellence and innovation in visual arts. I wanted to interview them. They were just never standing next to the computer when I was there. So unfortunately, I could not interview them. Other major winners were Number None's innovative time manipulation platform title Braid, which I did play, and I actually did meet one of the developers who declined to be interviewed and actually asked us not to do any jokes about, you know, trying to interview nobody, because I was going to do that. And he kind of said, no, please don't do that. We're taking this seriously. So infer what you will. He was a nice guy, though, but the game was not done. The demo was not done. He's kind of embarrassed that it's up in its form that it is now. But it's a 2D version of Prince of Persia. Or Blinks. That's pretty much what it is. You can, if you miss a jump, you can hold down R and it goes back. And it's a side scroller. It's not really a fast moving platformer. It's more of a, if you played Professor Fizzwizzle, it's about that speed using, you know, 2D sprites and stuff. And let's see, Dad and Me by Newgrounds, that won Best Web Browser Game, and the Audience Award went to Dofus, who actually, I got an email from Christopher Fleury, who says, yes, it does have a tutorial, you just have to click on the eagle. And that just wasn't apparent, so that's why I didn't get to go into the tutorial on that. And then AdultSwim.com, which made all the bumpers on the show, so you had to actually read the screens and stuff, and it was kind of funny. They gave their prize, which was a $5,000 award, to Dodge That Anvil. Which did have audio when I walked by it at the IGF Festival. So it really did have some audio, and sounded pretty good. Now, I interviewed a couple of the finalists. Either they weren't at the computer or they declined to give an interview at that time. Actually, one of the other people, I actually skipped over one. Weird Worlds, Return to Infinite Space. They were great guys. They won Innovation in Audio. And they were there, and they were, you know, they actually look like pirates. It's kind of funny, without the eye patch. And they were really cool. And actually, one of the things was, I saw, when I first saw them at the IGF, they were being talked to by Steve Jackson. Now, if you don't know who Steve Jackson is, he's the head of Steve Jackson Games. They do a lot of the card, they do like the Illuminati card game, the card and table games like that. I remember them from the 80s because their BBS got taken by the FBI in the 80s, back when cybercrime was new and nobody knew what was going on. But anyway, they make all those games, and they had a long conversation. I had to wait to talk to the Weird Worlds guys. Unfortunately, his voice was crackling, and so he really didn't want to be interviewed that day, and they just weren't there on the final day when I was there. But I did get a copy of their full game, so I'm going to actually play it more because there is more to it than what I talked about on the show last week. But here we have a couple of the interviews from the IGF, and we will be right back here on the Bobby Blackwolf Show on All Games Radio.
I'm here with Brett, an artist with Ominous Development for Strange Attractors. Brett, one of the things that we talked about when I talked about this game last week is the disturbing sound effects. Of the crying children, that it seemed like I was beating children. How did those come about, and what, you know, why did you choose to go that route with the sounds?
Well, they're little helpless spacemen. I mean, they had to be making some sort of sound, and they're being flung to their death. They have to scream. And basically, the sound effects took us about a weekend with my friend in his apartment, and just having fun screaming in a microphone.
Now, enough about that. Tell us about, like, you know, why you guys decided to design this type of game. You know, why is there only, you know, one control? You know, tell us a little bit about the thought process behind that.
It's basically done for a One Switch gaming competition for RetroRemakes.com. They teamed up with OneSwitch.uk.org, and sort of a corporation that develops handicap games. So one button design, very simple.
Now, about, you know, because it really does look like it realistically handles gravity, at least in a 2D universe and stuff, how difficult was that for the team to come up with and, you know, get those in the game?
The actual gravity equation is very simple. It's been around for, about 400 years. Newton developed it. And, I don't know, we had an existing game engine that has all the collision detection already built in there, so just laying that gravity on top of that was very simple for us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm here with Brad McDonald from Large Animal Games, Saints and Sinners Bowling. He was the art director. Brad, what gave you guys the idea to make this bowling game?
With all of our games, we usually like to start with something that has a sense of the familiar, something that's going to be familiar to the players, and then apply some twist to it that sort of distinguishes it from, well, anything else that would be on the market, ideally. And with this game, we had already done Saints and Sinners Bingo, and had some success with that. And so we wanted to sort of extend that, well, in a way, a mini franchise of games, this Saints and Sinners theme for the game, and which is all about applying charms and, like, twisting fate to your benefit with a pretty standard traditional game.
Now, you said you had another bowling game that you had done before that you kind of used into this. What was that one about, if people have never heard of it?
Rocket Bowl was also in the IGF last year, and the idea is that you're the players in the 1958 Kalamazoo World's Fair, and the courses, the levels are actually these sort of contoured miniature golf-style levels, and the ball you could launch, and they're 360 degrees, there's no sense of really an alley, and you could apply rocket propulsion to, like, direct the path of the ball to knock down any number of pin sets.
Now, this looks like a fun game to play with, you know, play with my friends and stuff. Is there any multiplayer in this, or is there multiplayer coming down the pike, maybe?
Our dream when we first started it, we wanted to make it multiplayer and build that just into the downloadable. And the realism of, like, what we could handle with our budget and timeline kicked in. But what we did include was a turn-based mode, so you can sit down at the computer and play with a friend. And then there is a Flash version of the game that's online, which actually has a lobby you can log in, and it's truly multiplayer.
Now, how long did it take you guys from, like, design to, you know, to now? How long did you guys spend on this project?
I think the entire project life cycle was about a year. It was like 12 months. 8 months of which were like a team of people dedicated to the project working full time.
Now, in this game, you can actually use charms. For people who haven't played it, you can use charms against your opponent or to help you. What is your favorite charm in the game?
My favorite charm has got to be either the Super Hazard, which drops like construction road cones in the alley to, like, thwart your opponent's ball's progress, or the lead pins charm. Like, they're both very good offensive charms. Now, as a special guest here on the Bobby Blackwolf Show, I'm here with Mr. Mad Buggy Lawrence Young from All Games Interactive. He has been playing this game. What do you think of this one?
It was fine all the way up until I shot the ball directly through the one, and what is that? I don't even know what pins those are. The right through the center pins, and gave myself the worst split ever in bowling. It's very fun. It's very fun. I like it a lot. I'm gonna have to go ahead and see if I can get it at my computer at home, because it's good stuff. It's good stuff.
Now, how can people get this on their computer at home? Where can they go to get it? And how much is it if it's cost something?
Sure.
You can buy it through our website. It's www.largeanimal.com. It's also distributed through MSN Zone, Yahoo Games, Real Arcade. And you can play the free trial for an hour through any of those sites and then buy the game after an hour for $19.95. Now, what is Mr. Mad Buggy here doing wrong when he's playing this game? What is he doing wrong here? I see. I gotta watch. Well, I could say the thing that he's doing right is he keeps playing. In terms of what he's doing wrong, I think he's just not getting the right angle on that one pin. You don't want to go straight through the one. You want to kind of just clip it to the side, and that's going to get the strike. Thank you very much. I'm here with David and Suzanne Brooks from Black Mountain Games. They did Putnuts. Where did the opening song come from? That's my first question.
Putnuts, Putnuts, Chip Ace, T-Birdie, Dimple, and Duff. Putnuts, Putnuts, for the love of the game and the thrill of the putt.
Christopher Dale, he was nominated Best Local Recording Artist in San Diego. He was kind enough to lend his voice to our game and give it a whole story. For us, we wanted people to understand what the story was before they started the game, and he just beautifully, through music, tells that story for us.
Now, going down actually to the real game, this is actually coming out for the PS2 and it's being developed for the PS2 and the PSP as well as the PC. You know, what made you want to do that instead of just making the PC game? Most of these here are actually just PC games. So it's kind of weird to see, you know, PS2 and PSPs in the IGF. What made you decide to go that route?
Well, we really wanted to have the game be fast-paced, have a real console style, real console arcade feel to it. To contrast the other golf games on the marketplace, which are all more slower-paced golfing sims, traditional golfing sims. So it was really important that we build it on the console so it has that console feel and it has the has all the things that you expect out of a console game that you probably wouldn't get out of a typical PC miniature golf game or a golf game. And that was the best way to do it, was to build it on the console.
Now, how did you get the dev kits to do this? How'd you get those?
We originally built the first prototype for the game on a commercially available Linux kit for PlayStation 2. They have a version of Linux that turns your PlayStation 2 into basically a PC with, you know, that has a cool graphics chip. And we showed that to Sony, and they loved what we did and got us our start. And then we got pro dev kits and made the game, and then we ported it to PC and for also PlayStation Portable.
Now, how long did it take you to? How long have you been working on the game? Probably from initial design to, you know, programming.
You know, we started about 3 years ago. We built the prototype. It took us about 2 years to build the PS2 game, and then for the last year, we've been porting it to PC, porting it to PlayStation Portable, and then also just tweak and polish on all three platforms. So,
now we were talking before I started the recording of that. You're making it very children friendly, you know, talking to school children. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. For us, because it's miniature golf, we really wanted to make it easy for anyone to sit down and pick up a controller and play the game. So part of our design element was, instead of having a lot of button mashing, all you have to do is hit the X key, repeat. If you do nothing else but hit the X key repeatedly, you'll wind up at the first hole and ready to play. Nothing tricky, nothing crazy. One of the other things we do too is we go into our local school and give presentations on how we use math and video games, and then we ask the kids to each take a hole and play, and we use that feedback from the kids to, again, make the game easier and make it more accessible for them. If we feel if they have a good experience, then everyone benefits from it.
How do you guys expect to get this published? I know people can get a PC demo of this for the PC, but it's really a PS2 game.
And, I mean, I as I said on my show last week, you know, I got confused with the help screen that was in PS2 controller mode, and my PS2 controller didn't work. And you guys are fixing that. You guys were saying that beforehand, so I wanted to get that out there. How are you expecting to get it out on the PS2 and the PSP? Do you have a publisher lined up, or how's that working?
No, I mean, this show is a great platform to show the games to publishers. They're all here, and you get a chance to come by and see the game. It's really just, at this point, just trying to find a publisher that sees the same vision that we do, that miniature golf deserves to be on consoles and is a great game, so...
Now, in this game, you can actually have different types of balls that help you in different situations. Which one's your favorite, each of you?
I like the boom ball. The boom ball is the best. It's noisy, it's powerful, it destroys, it destructs, it blows things up, and it gets a big reaction out of just about any kid or anybody that plays it. So that's my favorite, for sure.
You know, I have to go with the king ball. I mean, not only does it have all the other attributes of the other 23 balls, but it's purple, and it happens to be my favorite color. So the king ball is the one that's the hardest to get, but also the most rewarding to receive.
Thank you very much. Good luck with getting the publishing on this.
Thank you very much.
I'm here with Keith Nimitz from Mousechief. He did The Witch's Yarn, which is probably one of the most interesting adventure games I've seen in a long time. The way it works, it's like a play, and you're actually the director in the play. What gave you the inspiration to make an adventure game in that fashion?
I had initially had a concept for driving an adventure game, where instead of controlling the character directly and moving her through the environment, where you had a fairly, actually for most people, a fairly complex set of commands, even in the old SierraVenture click environment of just nouns and verbs, that's actually pretty difficult for people to just pick up and start playing. So if I had a model where I reduced it to basically a list of characters and elements of the story that you could introduce into the story to make the change, to create a scene, and each new scene adds to the story, and each choice that you make takes that story in a specific direction based on who it is that you've introduced into this story.
Now, how long have you spent from, like, design and, you know, production and all that on The Witch's Yarn total?
There was a lot of upfront thinking about the game without a lot of coding. So that took about 3 or 4 months. I kind of explored things. I wasn't sure exactly the type of genre I was going to make. I went to a GDC about 3 years ago, and they were just talking about this casual game market with, older women, largely driving that market. And I felt that if I could come up with a compelling story that would appeal to them, then I could use the advantage of my new command system to introduce people who've never played an adventure game before. So The Witch's Yarn came out of that.
Now, I noticed also that you were using you have a scripting language, a compiled scripting language. Did you also develop that, or did you use existing tools for that?
I created my own scripting language. I built my own engine. I am using Python and Pygame as the elemental code that I'm writing in. And they've been very, very good to me. They're very efficient for developing a code. The entire engine was written in about 2 months. There was some tweaking after that, but mostly I was able to concentrate on just getting the scripts, the story, the gameplay together.
So what you're continually updating The Witch's Yarn, you were telling me before. What can we expect in the future? You know, if people have maybe already tried the game, you know, should they come back and try it now, you know, or once you've updated a little bit?
Yeah, there's been significant changes to the game since it was shipped about a year ago. I completely rewrote the first chapter in June and made it a very different experience. And now I'm going about and basically changing who my audience is by targeting people who actually have more experience on it, whereas the very simple introduction was kind of confusing them. They bring a lot of expectations, and those expectations have to be handled early on before they start doing things that they're used to doing and get them accustomed to the new model. Yeah.
Now, would this engine possibly be used in other type of stories, or is it kind of tied down to this particular story, or is it easy to kind of create a new script and create a new background?
Well, there's two parts to the engine, and neither of them both of them can support any kind of story, but there's the presentation system, and then there's the low-lying kind of like adventure game system under that. The presentation system is currently 2D, presents everything fairly statically. There's some animations, but mostly it's just like more like a comic book, and it's very text-based. I would like to do another game based on the controlling technology is called Direct Inject, and I would like to do another game based on Direct Inject where I had a live 3D world where the characters were much more mobile and agile and always moving, and you influence that environment by, again, introducing characters and objects into the world and seeing how the characters in the current camera react to that and produce the story. That would cost me quite a bit more. I'm actually seeking funding for that now, but I don't know if that'll go. I'm working on something else, so...
Now, I know that there's like a large community of people who write interactive fiction and stuff like that. Is there a possibility that you'd release, you know, like, let people write their own scripts and use your engine? Or is that something that you're thinking of maybe in the future to have, like, fan-created content?
Yeah, I'm actually very interested in doing that. I originally had planned to do that but the engine really isn't quite ready yet to do that. I can mess with it. I'm the guy who created it. I don't get too confused anymore. But to really make it right, I'd have to go through another development process. And that's actually what I would do as far as when I created the next title. That would be the first part that I did, was actually revamp the engine. There's some technology that I've added to it for other purposes, and roll that into another story, and then make it much more friendly to someone who just wants to like write the scripts, run the compiler, and watch the cool stuff happen from the engine.
So where can people check out The Witch's Yarn, pick it up?
Go to mousechimp.com. Easy download. It's 8 megabytes, real quick. You can play the first two chapters for free. It is for sale, $20, starting chapter 3. Hopefully you get a really good sense for the game, whether it's your kind of story or not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that was all of the people that would talk to me from the IGF, either they were there or whatever. Now, Fantas says that he wants to go back to playing Oblivion. It's calling him, so I am going to open up my Skype line and our toll-free number. Skype line is Bobby Blackwell Show's. Toll-free number is 1-866-880-0156. I want someone to call me and tell me about Oblivion. I want to buy this game. I'm going to buy this game, but it came out Tuesday, and I flew out Tuesday morning, and I came back, got back home late last night. And so I want somebody to tell me about Oblivion, first person who can get in. I'll send you a soundtrack of your choice, or not of your choice. I've got a list of a couple of game soundtracks, and I got Jade Empire soundtrack, the Destroy All Humans soundtrack, the Cameo soundtrack, and there's some others. They're over in the other room, so I don't have them on me. But if you want a soundtrack, free soundtrack, I'll send it to you. Give me a call and talk about Oblivion for about 5-10 minutes, and that'd be great. While I'm waiting for that, I will start talking about the Will Wright talk, which was filled the auditorium. It made me feel dumb. Because he's such a smart guy, and he talks so fast and such a high level. He split his talk into two parts, and it was kind of interesting. One was about astrobiology, and the other one was about researching for game design. And he would flip between these two topics every 10 minutes. And he would just stop what he was talking about, flip to the other topic, talk about that, then flip back to the topic that he was originally on, and start right where he left off. So he was giving two talks at once in 10-minute segments. It was really, really interesting, to say the least. And there's a lot of stuff he was talking about, Drake's Equation, Rare Earth Theory. There's a couple write-ups on it. I could not keep up, so I did not write any notes. He had a lot of assets in that PowerPoint presentation. I wonder how long it took him to do that. That's the Will Wright talk. He is an amazing individual. He really is smart, and he deserves everything he gets in the game industry. Not much info about Spore the game. The research part was talking about how he researched how to make Spore, which originally was called Sim Everything, and he actually showed the mock-up box for Sim Everything, and even showed the requirements for Sim Everything, which is really funny. It was astronomical system requirements. Windows QD with, 1 terabyte of RAM, stuff like that. And Tiger Claw says, sound like you need to be a rocket scientist to understand. He talked about rocket scientists and stuff. It was a very, really, really good talk. And I will talk a little bit about the Ron Moore talk, which was on Wednesday at the same time in the auditorium. He didn't quite fill the auditorium, but there were a lot of fanboys and fangirls there. This is about the TV show. The television show, basically, what he did is his presentation was filled with video where he would play a scene from the original series and then a scene just like it in the new series. So, he'd show, the conflict between Adama and Apollo from the old series and then the same conflict about probably the same thing in the new show, and I'm not going to go too much into it, but, you know, the show is based around what he calls the Family Adama. And it's a very, if you've never watched the show, it's a sci-fi show, but it's very drama-esque. There's no aliens. There's no other life form. There's only so much you can do with foreheads, is what he said, you know, because we are human. So it's basically them alone in space. It's just them and the Cylons. So the show revolves around the Family Adama, which in the original series had Adama, Apollo, Zack, who was killed in the pilot of the first of the original series, and Athena, which was his daughter, also serving on the ship. Well, in the new series, that is still there, except Zack's killed before the pilot, and you got Adama and Apollo, and then Starbuck is the daughter role. So if you look at it that way, and it looks like he's it's the daughter. Now, I'm going to be spoiling the miniseries of the new Battlestar Galactica in this, so if you haven't watched it and you want to, this is like a major underlying theme of the show, but it's spoiled because it's the last second of the miniseries where this is revealed. There's actually, it was supposed to be a second family, and it was going to be Boomer, Chief Tyrell, and Boxy, who was the kid. And you could actually see Boxy in some of the original episodes. That was supposed to be the underlying family, and that's what they wrote the entire miniseries. And one of the producers said, you know what would be cool and assured that this would get picked up is if we revealed that Boomer was a Cylon. That's the spoiler. And Ron Moore says, you know what? You're absolutely right. And so they did not change the miniseries at all. So if you watch the miniseries, you can see that, you know, there was nothing in there about her being a Cylon until that very last scene. They didn't change anything at all. So, you know, that was pretty much one of the big revelations. And, you know, it was a very, very, very interesting talk. Seeing all the side-by-sides, how they did the set redressing. And it was basically about how to adapt something old into something new. That's why he was there. And the first thing he said is, I don't understand why I'm at the game developer conference. I don't write video games. But here's my video game. Somebody please make it. And this is Ron Moore's video game. It's a first-person shooter. And you shoot a lot of agents who want to take 10% of your cut. You go through and you mow down television executives and all that stuff who want to, you know, screw up your show. And I think the final fight takes place at a sci-fi convention in Minneapolis on stage with Walter Koenig. So that is Ron Moore's idea of a video game. So somebody should make it. Okay, nobody wants the soundtrack. I'm going to shut off the phones again. Sorry, guys. I wanted somebody to call in and talk about Oblivion because I haven't been able to play it at all. And guess nobody wanted that soundtrack. So we'll keep the soundtracks. I'll actually have a better list of the soundtracks a little bit later on. Now, two things I saw that I do want to say that, you know, were really cool. Game Developer Conference, one of the neat things is it's more showing the developers what technologies are out there and just neat technology, stuff you really wouldn't see at E3. One of these was called the Novint Falcon, novint.com/falcon.htm. This is force feedback to the max. Not only does this force feedback, it also pushes back and gives you, you know, tactile touch. So the first demo of it was this sphere, and you could actually push forward on this device, and you can see pictures of it on that website I just linked, and it'll be on our show notes. You push forward, and it'll actually stop, and you can actually feel around the sphere. Then they put sandpaper on it, and then when you rubbed on it, it actually felt like sandpaper, this little thing that you were touching. And then they put, like, bigger bumps, and so, like, you'd actually jump across. And so, you know, you'd slide all the way across, and ice actually felt like ice. It was very slippery. There were some other demos, like one where you controlled a baseball glove, and when you caught the baseball, it actually jerked back. It was a very weird feeling. There was another one with looked like pool balls, pool table balls, and you had a rubber band, and you attached a rubber band to them. You could pick them up and swing them around, and it would actually feel like you were swinging around a ball with a rubber band. It was really, really cool. This is a USB device. They plan on having it out on the consumer market in 2007 for about $150 when they start, and then when they start mass producing it in large quantities, they hope to get it under to $99. So it's a very interesting device. I'd love to see real games working on it, and you know, I may buy two and get a boxing game for it because it's not just force feedback, but it'll actually jerk you around. Like if you're firing a gun, you'll actually get recoil. And it will actually be harder to move and stuff. So that was one of the cool things that I saw. This other one was from Mitsubishi Electric Research Laboratories. It's called the Merle Diamond Touch Table. What this does, you've probably all seen these tables that actually have stuff from where you can like affect what's on like the floor by stomping on it. They have some of these things at Disney World. I saw it, and you know, you've seen them in E3 on the floor where you can like stomp on the TIE fighters. This is kind of different. The chairs that you sit in are wired, and when you touch the screen, it you know knows what you're doing. And this is because it's sending a current from your ass to your finger, and I really just wanted to say that on the air. Basically, it knows it's you touching the table. Now, if somebody's standing and touching the table, it won't do anything because there's no current. Essentially, when you touch the table, it completes that circuit. And so there's four sides of the table. One person is yellow, one person is blue, one person is red, one person is some other color. That they only had room for three people, so I don't know what the fourth color was. And like there would be a game where you either had to pop all these balloons that were on the table, but you only could pop your balloon or a purple balloon, which was 2 points. And it knew who was popping what. There was another one where you had to blow up these other balls on the table, but you had to have your hand down and encompassing that ball, and you had to high-five one of the other players that was sitting down. And then there's another one, if you actually look on Google for Merle Diamond Touch, you'll actually see this one where there's like a couple of donut circles, but they have like mazes, and you can move your color. And then, you know, you're trying to get like this little thing into the center of the maze. It was really, really interesting. And so it's just technology like that. That's where things are going. I don't know how much that a lot of people use that for collaborative business stuff. That's what the site is and all that. Going back to the recoil thing, and I'm going to mispronounce his name. Kafus Potato asks, "What if you hit yourself with the recoil?" We're going back to the Novent Falcon. It's not that bad. I mean, it's like it'll jerk just a little bit. I mean, if you look at the device on that page, you can actually see that it's really not that big, and it's not going to really hit you in the face or anything. It's just a small recoil that does enough to make it hard for you to aim, which is what happens when you have a real gun. Fifth Dream says, "You guys realize this thing is the first step to Evangelion." So, and DC Nate, thank you, DC Nate, for actually linking these URLs. We will have these URLs in the show notes if you can't be in chat. So those were the neat things that I saw at GDC. I sat in on some game audio stuff. I sat in on the Gang Demo Derby, which was essentially 2 hours where they played like 1 minute of some guy's piece and had like a panel of like Tommy Tallarico and Jack Wall and the director of music at Sony, the director of music at EA, and a couple other guys, unfortunately I don't remember, but they were really cool, and basically they'd give like a 1 minute critique saying, you know, would we buy your music for our game and stuff. And it was interesting, the song that got the most ovation from the game audio crowd was the menu music from Civilization 4, done by a great kid named Christopher Tam. And I got to meet him. He was really great. That the song with the Lion King stuff. And so that was what I sat in on. I also sat in on a music licensing one. Stuff that we can probably get some more stuff on All Games Radio in our 24/7 stream. The last thing that I attended when I was there was Video Games Live. And we've talked about Video Games Live. We had an hour and a half long interview with Tommy Tallarico. And it was a great interview. We talked a lot about Final Fantasy in Video Games Live. It was there, as he said. Now, we didn't get our tickets until pretty late. We thought we were being taken care of, essentially. And, you know, things just didn't work out. So I bought tickets. We got in just fine. And so there was some problems with the thing. Like, they had these lights, and you know like how sometimes in some venues they have like rotating lights like on the wall? Well, unfortunately, there's no walls in the San Jose Civic Auditorium. It's just other seats. And so these bright lights would sometimes be coming into my vision, and so it was kind of hard to actually watch the stage because we were being used as ambiance for the rest. You know, and I don't understand why you have to light the crowd or light the audience. I don't understand, unless you're asking them a question and you want them to react, so you want to see them if you're on stage, but there's no reason to light the crowd. There was also some other issues with like syncing the video. I think their DVD operator might get fired after this. There was a couple of miscues stuff, and it's their first show, so I can kind of understand. I'm, you know, it was still an amazing show. If it ever comes in your area, please go get it. Buy your tickets early. Get a great seat. You're going to love it. But it was on a small stage, so like we didn't get some of the stuff that's shown in the trailer. You know, I thought it was amazing. There were some parts, you know, the Final Fantasy medley from Martin Leung, the video game pianist. It was really amazing. And, you know, there were parts that just made your hair stand up on end. And we were able to get backstage. Now, at every single Video Games Live event, there is a meet and greet. And since this was the Game Developer Conference, there was a bunch of people at this meet and greet. And after, at the end of the meet and greet, we actually went through and asked a short question of everybody in that meet and greet. We're talking 20 people from in the industry, and we're going to play them all for you right now. It's usually one question from everybody, except when we get to Jack Wall, who was the conductor, we ask him another one, and then Tommy Tallarico, I actually air some gripes, and he curses me out for getting bad seats. So it's going to be very fun, and so I want to thank everybody for talking to us. They had already gone through a very long line of meet and greet. When Video Games Live comes to your town, the meet and greet is free. It will be after the show. They'll talk about it during the show. And, you know, you can meet some really great people. And they love, love meeting their fans. And the show was sold out. It was an amazing show. So please go check it out. So here is the industry's reaction to Video Games Live from San Jose on Friday night, here on the Bobby Blackwell Show on All Games Radio.
I'm here with Lori Robinson, the vocalist from Advent Rising. Did you ever think when you signed on to do a video game you would be standing on stage and getting that reaction after a performance?
Absolutely not. No, we had no idea. We were so happy to be brought onto the project and as co-composers, and then by default I actually ended up singing, and I wasn't even supposed to be the singer. There was another singer who was supposed to be on the video game, but they kept my vocal. I did the scratch vocal, and then here we are. It's the craziest thing in the whole world, but it's because of Tommy Tallarico. He's just an amazing person, and you know, he's the one that makes all the crazy stuff happen, you know, so it's really a delight to be involved with him, you know. So yeah.
And it's Martin Leung, the video game pianist. What was it like being on stage and getting that type of reaction from a performance?
I really enjoyed playing here. It was an honor. And I enjoyed playing video game music. And it's always fun to play for a crowd that really is into video game music, is passionate about it as just as I am. And it was a pleasure. And I truly enjoyed it.
And you got the standing ovation. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Keith Robinson, one of my heroes from Intellivision here. You've been in this industry for a long time. How does it feel to see that type of reaction for video game music finally?
This is fantastic. The reaction is wonderful. The great thing is the music today, unlike what we did in the early days, really can show the emotion of the games. It really it kind of shows what the games are all about and what they mean to the players. It's not just, you know, shoot them up and everything. You can really tell the emotion and the challenge and everything comes through the music. It's a vital part of the games. And it's wonderful to see the reaction. It's wonderful to see the audience react the way they did.
Cliffy B, he did the Unreal franchise. My girlfriend loves him for Jazz Jackrabbit, and he's working on Gears of War, but he's here at Video Games Live. What did you think of the reaction of a sold-out crowd finally enjoying video game music?
I wasn't able to attend the one at the Hollywood Bowl, and I'd heard a lot about it. And I have to say, I was completely heartwarmed, and it reminded me why I do what I do. And I'm looking forward to having Gears of War in next year's edition of it.
That's just our careers.
David Perry, he did Earthworm Jim, Aladdin, Enter the Matrix, Path to Neo. He's done stuff with All Games with Scott Rubin, so it's a pleasure to have him on my show finally. David, what did you think about Video Games Live, about the reaction of that sold-out crowd?
I think it's amazing that that Tommy and Jack have managed to pull this together. They're also running a show here because they have the video game conference going on at the same time, and they've got lots of video game awards ceremony and everything else for audio, and then suddenly they have to rush over here and pull together a live concert with all these moving parts. They've done an incredible job. I'm lucky because I'm very close with Tommy, and he did a lot of the music for my first games, and so he invited me to the rehearsal. I went to the Hollywood Bowl. This is my third time now seeing it, and you know what? I still really enjoy it. It doesn't get old. Trust me. You come and see this puppy again, you'll enjoy it just as much. So overall, I just love it.
And I'm here with Alexander Brandon. He worked on Unreal Tournament. He used to be a member of Straylight Productions. I remember them from a long time ago, back in my old PC demo days. You've been in here in this industry so long, and now you've finally seen a sold-out crowd enjoy video game music live. How did that feel to see that reaction?
Absolutely incredible. I mean, you know, it's indescribable, really, what these guys, Tommy and Jack, are doing for the industry, and you know, how, you know, just grandiose game music can really be when you put it in front of a live audience and, you know, live orchestra with all the video and all the lights. It's just, I'm actually kind of talking like Tommy does in the promo video, but, you know, he's absolutely right. I mean, it's an amazingly big step forward for everybody in terms of, you know, market awareness, and I'm in full support. I can't wait to go to the next concert.
I'm here with Jason Hayes. He did the music from the Warcraft series and got the loudest ovation tonight when his music started. What did that feel like? Because I know you were in the audience.
It was incredible. I mean, like, ever since the first show they did with this, that was a rush. I think I didn't even know what was going on. It was surreal. I don't remember hearing anything that night. This time I actually got to listen and sit back, and it was a thrill. It was absolutely incredible. Incredible.
And I'm here with Laura Cartman. She worked on EverQuest 2, which was also played tonight. How did it feel seeing a sold-out crowd enjoying your music as played on stage?
Oh, it's a great feeling. We had a great crowd tonight. I think even more and more enthusiastic crowd tonight than we did at the Hollywood Bowl last summer. But it's a great thing, and I really, really respect Tommy and Jack for putting this thing together, and I'm so pleased to be a part of it.
I'm here with Enon Zur. He worked on Prince of Persia: Two Thrones, EverQuest, and SOCOM 2. How did it feel to be in there and watching a sold-out crowd enjoying video game music?
Well, we're so flattered and amazed by the amazing wave of excitement and love that this all beautiful crowd is giving us. It's just a great feeling to be appreciated. And I think we really owe Tommy and Jack a lot of thanks for, you know, putting everything together. And we would love to keep on contributing music for everybody and for a long time.
I'm here with Richard Jakes, who worked on Headhunter, Outrun 2, and Jet Grind Radio. How did it feel to be in there, watching the sold-out crowd, enjoying video game music finally?
It was an amazing experience just to see all the video game fans come together to watch the music from all their favorite games with a live orchestra and the video screens. It was just a tremendous experience to see so many fans.
And I'm here with Chris Velasco. He worked on Splinter Cell, Double Agent, and God of War, which was played tonight. How did it feel to hear a sold-out crowd enjoy your music and give that kind of reaction?
Well, to me, it's just a completely surreal experience, and I just feel like the luckiest guy in the world to be part of such an amazing industry, and I'm just so happy to see everyone else enjoying it too.
I'm here with Jason Enos. He's the producer of Metal Gear Solid and Dance Dance Revolution. He's also working on Beatmania, my favorite game of all time. But how did it feel to be in there and watching an entire sold-out crowd of people enjoying video game music?
Well, I mean, for me, I was really moved. You know, Metal Gear Solid was one of the first, you know, opening pieces that was played. And, you know, for me, I've been working with Tommy and a long time on getting that into this program. And, you know, to see it all culminate on this night with everybody in the audience and just really just embracing the music, it's just... It just is a really big sign of how big video gaming has become, and that music in gaming is not just some bloops and blops anymore. It's real music that people can love and enjoy and listen to without having to play the game.
I'm here with Will Littlejohn. He worked on Guitar Hero. Nothing else needs to be said on that. How does it feel to see video game music finally taking center stage?
Well, it was really amazing to see all this amazing music by all these great composers out there with a live orchestra in front of thousands of people. It's really is like seeing the whole industry come to fruition. It's amazing.
I'm here with Tim Larkin. He worked on 8,623 games, according to his piece of paper, but most like, including Rugrats, but he mainly worked on Myst, and that's what was played tonight. How did it feel to have your music played on stage and enjoyed by a sold-out crowd?
Okay, I'm just a little disappointed that Rugrats wasn't actually played this evening, but other than that, the Myst stuff came out great. It was awesome. It's a great feeling. You can't explain it.
and I'm here with Chance Thomas. He worked on King Kong, X-Men, Lord of the Rings, and a bunch of, like, the Chub Chubs and a bunch of other stuff that's on here. You know, you've been around the industry in a while. How does it feel to actually see a sold-out crowd enjoying video game music finally?
I was really jealous because none of my stuff was being played, but it was amazing, man. Some of the greatest music in the business being played by a live orchestra and a choir with a light show. It was just fantastic. I loved it all.
I'm here with Gerard Marina. He worked on God of War. And how did it feel to have your music played on stage and get that type of reaction from a sold-out crowd?
It's great. And then really, it's the crowd that really kicks it home as one of the greatest experiences. You know, we slave away in our dark little studios all by ourselves. And then, if it's played in front of that many people and they all cheer, you know you did something good, you know? There's no denying it. You can't convince yourself that it could have been better if you hear a bunch of people scream. So that is just what we live for.
And I am here with probably everyone's hero, Marty O'Donnell, who worked on Halo and Halo 2 and a couple other stuff that really is inconsequential to Halo and Halo 2. Halo is the finale for Video Games Live, and it gets a huge reaction. How does it feel to be in there and watching a sold-out crowd react that much to your music?
It's like a dream, actually. Jack and Tommy are gracious guys, and the fact that they let me be the finale is unbelievable. So I really, really, really love it. These guys are great, and hearing the crowd react like that makes it all worthwhile. Whatever work you do on a game and going through crunch, to have this kind of honor and accolades and just to see that the people like it, it's unbelievable. It's great. Thanks.
And I'm here with Jack Wall. He worked on Jade Empire, and he was the conductor for tonight's festivities, so he was on the stage the entire time. How was the crowd? How was the energy from the crowd, from the stage where you were?
Oh, man, it was just amazing. And it just sort of reminds you of why we're musicians, and getting out there live and just making it come alive is so much fun. I mean, it just really reminds you why you do it. You know, love it.
Now, I perform in two local community wind symphonies, and when I learned about the Alfred Publishing deal that Video Games Live is doing for marching bands, high school bands, the orchestras, and all that, the conductor, one of them, he's a professor of music at a college, he's got his doctorate, he actually said, and I quote, "I don't think this is the right medium for that type of music." How would you respond to somebody like that who's from the music world, the academic music world, about playing video game music?
Well, we're not going to school, you know. Basically, there's a lot of players out there who seem to really love what we're doing. The kids, you know, if they love the music, they'll play more music. This is their music. This may not be his music, but it's the people who play these games. It is their music. It's the new radio for the 21st century. It's all of that. So, you know, I mean, maybe it's not for him, but it's definitely for a lot of other people. Clearly, I mean, tonight was sold out, and we had a great time, so.
And I'm here with Tommy Tallarico. He's worked on about 10,624 games, including Earthworm Jim, Advent Rising, which was played tonight, and he is also the man that was the MC for all of this tonight. How did it feel just being up there? How was the reaction?
Oh, I mean, I tell you, the energy level tonight in the crowd was unbelievable. I mean, you know, you got to think, you know, most people in the crowd have been waiting like their entire lives for something like this, you know, and to do the very first video game concert in the birthplace of video games, Silicon Valley, is just unbelievable. It was a trip.
We only have a few minutes here. Just remember that. Okay. No, I actually have some beefs because I was there. I was here in the office. I actually have some beefs. I was on the side. I was in kind of like there's about five rows on the side. And I am a big EverQuest 2 fan. And I wanted to see that video. Unfortunately, there was this light that was swirling around in my eyes. And I had to, like, shield my eyes from the light. Is, you know, what happened with that? I mean,
you need to buy better tickets next time. That's all I'm saying. You know, you blame me on the lights, but, you know, you get those crappy seats the day before the show. You got to get your stuff early. I mean, there's a lot of people who want to see this, you know. You're standing on the side of the stage for crying out loud. No. The lights are a big part of the show, you know, and every venue we play in is a little different. So, you know, EverQuest might blind you this time, and Halo might bring you into an epileptic seizure. But, you know, that's fun to some people.
Now, the other thing is, other than the fact that my seats suck, I've always watched those trailers that are on videogameslive.com. And, you know, when Tron came on, I was so looking forward to seeing the light cycle zoom across the stage. I was so looking forward to seeing, you know, the guy in the Tron costume with the disc. And all I saw the entire night in terms of, like, people on stage was the Metal Gear Solid guy with the exclamation point, which was hilarious.
You're giving away the show, Bobby!
It's on the web.
Okay. Yeah, but no. You know what it is that every single show, every venue we go into is different, right? Every show we play...
So how can I be giving it away if it's all different?
Okay, good point. But the thing is that, you know... That when we play the Hollywood Bowl, for example, you know, there's a big stage, and, you know, we just, as you saw up there, there was not really enough. We barely fit the oboe player on stage. I got to be honest with you. You know, he almost like, you know, had to sit behind the screen. But no, so every show you see, all the segments you see are going to be different, and you know, we just like to keep it fresh and keep it new. And like I said, depending on the situation, you know, and depending on the venue, you're going to get a different show every time.
Thank you very much for putting this on and taking it around. I hope you come to my area soon.
Where the hell you live? Oh, that's right, Atlanta. We're talking to some Dragon Con people. We'd like to play Atlanta. Exactly. I think Hotlanta. I think that's I think there's a lot of fans in that area as well. You know, I think we'd have a big crowd down in Atlanta. Sure. Where are we playing? What's that outdoor venue? Chastain Park. I want to play Chastain Park in Atlanta. Damn it. It's coming soon.
Let's make it happen.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Can we get...
And thank you to all of those people for taking their time. It was really late. It was like 12:30 in the morning, 1 in the morning or something when I was doing those. And they were all very nice. And, you know, even Chris Velasco, who had, like, his voice was hurting and stuff, he still said, no, I really want to do this interview with you. So I thought that was really, really cool. Kaifus Potato, I probably mispronounced it again, says, next time you talk to Tommy, tell him to bring the show to Canada. It's coming to Canada, I thought. Isn't it coming to Toronto or something? He's talking, I mean, they haven't announced all of the dates yet for this, but it is a world tour. They are going to, like, Tokyo and Rio de Janeiro and all that stuff, so... Sit tight. He does want to bring it back to Canada. It's already been to Canada once. It was in Vancouver. But he really does, you know, they're still working out these dates. And to be honest, the way it looks is look to see if there is an anime or a sci-fi convention in your area. They're partnering with conventions. They did the Game Developer Conference, and then they did the, you know, they're doing Wizard World and Philadelphia and Chicago and Dallas and stuff. So they're partnering with conventions. So if you have a major convention in your area, I mean, or even, you know, kind of a major convention, that may be the in that Video Games Live will use to come in. DC Nate, who was able to look up the link, says that Toronto and Montreal are on the coming soon part of the list, so that's a very good sign. You know, you will be able to get Video Games Live. They do want to bring it up there. They really do. For those who probably are music geeks like me, I will warn you, I mean, and it's amazing to see it perform live with the video that they've got synced up with it. The renditions of Super Mario Brothers and The Legend of Zelda, they do both medleys, are the exact same arrangements from the orchestral game concert series that the Tokyo Philharmonic did in the early 90s. So if you have those songs, you can probably hear them on All Games Radio. They're in rotation. They're the exact same ones. They do the same arrangement. They just put a video to it. And they do some really neat stuff with the theme from Mario and showing all of the Mario games right with the music. It was really great. And it is a really, really good show. There is a website that is actually going to have... They were also backstage. They were doing video after me and the meet and greet. And they are going to be hosting the arcade medley... Tommy's introductory speech and the Metal Gear Solid portion of Video Games Live on their site. It's Advanced Media Networks, advancedmn.com, or look it up in Google. I don't have their business card like in the room with me, so I can't make sure that's right. But it's Advanced Media Network, and they are going to have video. They took video of the beginning of Video Games Live. So if you really want to see what it's all about, check them out. They're great guys. I met them as we were waiting for the meet and greet to be done. Talked to them a whole lot, so check them out. I don't think it's up right now, but they're going to be editing the video and putting it up sometime this week, and it's probably going to kill their bandwidth. So anyway, that is everything about Video Games Live, about GDC. We have, that's pretty much, I've kind of blown my wad and talked about everything I wanted to talk to. I realize this is a long podcast, but it's a podcast. We're not, we don't have this whole you can only be on for an hour type of thing. So sorry for the people who expect a 45-minute podcast. When there's only 45 minutes worth of news, we'll talk about that. And Gita points out that the Kingdom Hearts arrangement is the same as the soundtrack as well. That's correct. Anyway, that's all that I'm going to inflict upon you guys this week here on the Bobby Black Wolf Show. Yes, All Games Interactive with Scott Rubin and Lawrence Young will be back each and every weeknight live from the Arena Interactive Lounge in West Los Angeles, California, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, right here on All Games Radio. Go to allgamesradio.com to tune into the stream. We will be back next Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, here on All Games Radio. Catch us live, interact with the show. Leave a voicemail with us on any topic, or leave a bumper for use on our show on our Skype line, Bobby Blackwell Show, all one word. You can also email your thoughts and opinions to me at blackwolf@allgames.com, and you can join our official forums at allgames.com to take part in our community. But we wouldn't be able to make the live show work without the chatters who have been sticking with us through the stream changes and the stream buffering and all that stuff. Apulo, DC Nate, Gita, Hendrix, Necobun, Broodwitch, Burr, Dark Unicorn, Drunk Pandas, GK128, Mako, Oshi, Rare, Refi, The Matrix, Action Hank, Alt, Arcatan, ATF Griff, Kafus Potato, Chrisville1724, D5T, Empty Thought, Fantaz, Fifth Dream, FireMac, Ichiban, Idian, Jwizzer, Libertarian, Mecha, OSU Fan, Prime Holy, Ravager, Seymour, who's playing Oblivion, boohoo to me, Shady45, Soul Brother Rules, Stone Raider, Sub-Z, TDB30, Tiger Claw, Twinson, and Wyland. So once again, I want to thank you all for being a part of the show tonight, and see you guys next week. I'm going to go play some Brain Age.
A winner is you. The views and opinions expressed on tonight's broadcast are not necessarily the views and opinions of All Games Productions. This file may be freely distributed provided the original content is unedited and proper attribution is retained. For more information about All Games programming, go to www.allgames.com.
And what do you think of Bob Rice?
Bob Rice. Well, let me tell you something about Bob Rice. He's the greatest guy, I mean, ever. Can I tell you something about Bob Rice? This fucking guy, Bob Rice. Ah, ah, I just, ah.